Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Donald Rumsfeld did it, Colin Powell too, so did George Tenet and Richard Clark. Now, after a week of accusations and pushback, political pressure and media hardball, the White House has today reversed its position and agreed to allow National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice to testify before the 9/11 Commission. Thomas Keane, current chairman of the commission, reacted positively to the announcement this afternoon.
We also commend the president for his decision to accept the commission's request for public testimony under oath by the assistant to the president for national security affairs, Dr. Condoleezza Rice.
The Bush administration had put up heated resistance to calls for sworn public testimony by Rice, insisting that putting the president's national security advisor in front of an investigative committee would violate the constitutional separation of powers. But in a quick press briefing a few hours ago, President Bush indicated that for now, the matter has been settled.
The commission and leaders of the United States Congress have given written assurances that the appearance of the national security advisor will not be used as precedent in the conduct of future inquiries.
And so, all eyes are on Condoleezza Rice. The National Security Advisor is at the center of a storm of controversy over the Bush administration's handling of 9/11. A brilliant woman of steely will, Rice has long been loyal to the Bush family, always seen as a steady advisor at the president's side. Now, she's accused of not knowing what Al-Qaeda was pre-9/11, of not being able to stand her ground in the face of the Cheney-Rumsfeld-Iraq war train, of not being fully straightforward about White House thinking and decision-making in the war on terror. It's a tough spot she's in. When she testifies, it will be on the record and under oath. The questions could be harsh. Tonight on Point, the White House about-face, Condoleezza Rice, and American security. Is the National Security Advisor's agreement to testify before the 9/11 Commission a breakthrough or not? What's your take on Condoleezza Rice's role in the White House? Did you see Condi Rice on 60 Minutes and the Sunday morning shows? Did she seem credible, an honest, in-charge National Security Advisor, or something else? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Kevin Whitelaw, senior writer at U.S. News and World Report. He co-authored the article, In the Eye of the Storm, Why President Bush's Closest Aide Has Just Become a Lightning Rod, in this week's magazine. Good evening and welcome, Kevin Whitelaw.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. Kevin, take us in to the back and forth that must have gone on between the White House and the 9/11 Commission to produce this outcome today, the green light for Condi Rice to testify.
Well, you know, the White House has been under tremendous political pressure to cave on this issue, as your introduction, alluded to. They've been getting hammered basically from just about every side, and they'd been holding back on trying on doing this, trying to avoid setting some sort of precedent about getting White House officials being called down to Congress. But many others have argued that precedent's already been violated before or broken before. And meanwhile, the scope of the inquiry and the attention surrounding it, given the high-profile testimony by former White House officials and other administration officials, her absence was extremely notable. And simply a lot of the testimony also did involve the first 8 months of the Bush administration, and she was just at the heart of that. And so not having her up there had just become a bigger and bigger political liability. In some ways, the question was, why did it take the White House so long to cave on something when a lot of people thought this was going to have to happen sooner or later?
After all the White House resistance, Kevin, is this going to be a letdown? Does Condi Rice, is there really a bombshell? Is there a question so keen and difficult for her to answer or not?
You know, it's really doubtful that you're going to find anything really all that surprising. A lot of this process, is, the public part of it, is really just about getting this stuff out in the public record for the American people to hear it. Remember that, you know, the commission's already had their chance to speak with her in private, as they have a number of other people. They've spoken to several hundred witnesses, and they've gone through a lot of documents. The real bombshell stuff coming out of the commission are actually, you know, it's actually in the staff statements that the commission is producing. These are really detailed, in-depth, and frankly, unprecedented glimpses into the way the government and the nation's intelligence apparatus and military and diplomatic and White House decision-making and law enforcement, all these other various bodies actually operate. And so that actually makes for fascinating reading. That's where the bombshells, if there are any, really are going to be coming. From the public testimony, what you're going to get at most are trying to elucidate some of the discrepancies that we've seen in public remarks between different officials. And so what obviously the questioning of Dr. Rice is going to focus on is going to be challenging her on Richard Clark's account of the opening months of the Bush administration and the decision-making process, and really what level of priority was the terrorism threat considered to be in the early months, and how aggressive was their decision-making. Basically, what Richard Clark has suggested was that this was not a terribly urgent priority.
Right.
The decision-making was relatively slow, and where they ended up was pretty much where Richard Clark had started on the first day of the administration, and from before then. And so she's going to be under pressure to try to, you know, basically refute that. It's not going to be easy, by the way, because the work done by the staff of the 9/11 Commission pretty much coincides quite closely with what Richard Clark has written in his book and given in his testimony.
Kevin, in your edition this week, you chronicle some sort of climb downs that Condi Rice has already had to make, backing off of statements, having statements contradicted by other facts in the public record.
Well, yeah, there are various points where she was out there probably a little further than she should have been. I think one of the biggest backtracks she did was an earlier statement where she said, "I don't think anybody could have predicted that these people would have taken an airplane and slammed it into the World Trade Center, that they would try to use an airplane as a missile." She's told the commission as she told us last week, that was maybe a little further than she meant to have gone.
In other words, that had been raised as a threat. It was not unknown.
She simply said that she personally had not been aware of it. She personally had not imagined it as what she really meant to have said. So to a certain degree, you can look at them as perhaps misstatements in the moment, but, there were a set of things. But at the same time, you know, she was also contradicting, at one point she publicly contradicted a statement from Vice President Cheney when Cheney had called Richard Clark out of the loop, which obviously seems a little silly given that he was actually the man that they turned to manage the crisis on September 11th.
And this just within the last couple of weeks. Is there a question, Kevin, that could come up in front of this commission under oath about who said or did what when that could be a real political problem for Condi Rice? Is there some, you know, we felt the commission wanting her under oath. It just leads you to scratch your head and imagine, well, maybe there's some question that's going to be so impossible for her to honestly answer without embarrassing someone that some, let's say, Democrat on this commission is dying to ask it.
Well, you know, keep in mind that it's actually a lot of the Republicans that are pushing extra hard for her to be on there. And what they say from Governor Thomas Keene, who's the one of the co-chairs of the commission, along with several other people, is they think she's actually going to be a very effective spokesman for the administration and will help clear things up and will present her case quite clearly. And so that's why I said earlier, she's getting it from both sides. The Republicans think that she's going to be able to offer a very good explanation and an account of exactly what the White House was doing.
Sort of staunch the bleeding here.
Now, at the same time, there's plenty of Democrats who want to get up there and say, okay, let's clear up what we've got on the record here, and let's really look at this and let's examine this for the president who's now running on his record as leading the war on terror. The one reason that there might be a little less of a gotcha here than there might be otherwise is the commission's mandate really doesn't extend into the question of whether the war in Iraq is part of the war on terrorism.
Right.
And that, in some ways, is some of the that's where some of the book's most heat, Richard Clark's book. Most heated rhetoric comes into play was his discussion of the war with Iraq, which he claims has actually made the country less secure. They can nibble around the edges on that one with her, but frankly, they can't get all that close. The most they'll be able to do is try to confirm Richard Clark's account that the president, when 9/11 happened, was eager to blame Iraq and actually had wanted to go after Iraq all along. But again, that's really a little out of the purview of the commission, so it's actually unlikely they're going to go there.
But we can imagine the needle being put in from a lot of directions. But Condi Rice is very cool under questioning. We saw that again on 60 Minutes over the weekend. Kevin Whitelaw, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation John Prados. He joins us from Maryland tonight. He's an analyst at the National Security Archive at George Washington University. He's author of Keeper of the Keys, A History of the National Security Council from Truman to Bush. Good evening and welcome, John Prados.
Hi, pleased to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. John, we want to expand our conversation a bit tonight to understand, to the extent that we can, the dynamic within the National Security Council and the White House around Condoleezza Rice, her role, how she's played it, how she's handled it, how it compares to national security advisors who have preceded her. Give us a little history on this institution to begin with. It was ironically brought to us, or maybe not ironically, but by Harry Truman in 1947. Why and with what membership?
Yeah, that's correct, actually. The National Security Council was created by the same law that created the job of the Secretary of Defense and the Central Intelligence Agency. It created the United States Marine Corps as a sort of a quasi-separate military service.
And the members
and
were supposed to be...
The National Security Council actually consists of the President and the Vice President and the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense sitting in council with the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Director of Central Intelligence as statutory advisors. And the entity that Condoleezza Rice heads, actually, the National Security Council staff, which is today the thing that everybody thinks of when somebody says NSC,
right,
grew willy-nilly entirely separately from this institution that was created in the 1947 law. As a matter of fact, Condoleezza Rice's job does not exist in United States statutes.
But it sure exists in tradition. When you look back over the last half century or so since this was created, how does Condoleezza Rice's handling of the job compare to her forerunners? Is she within the tradition of how it's normally been done? Is there something different going on here?
Oh, she's pushed the envelope in some interesting ways. Dwight Eisenhower was the first one to really employ a national security advisor in the sense that we use it today. And Kennedy and Johnson deepened their use of the person in that job and of the National Security Council staff. The NSC staff was really, really reached its stride in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. Kissinger pushed the envelope very far, and since then it has been one of the prime centers of power in the United States government. But national security advisors from then right through the Reagan era, really, did not have the kind of public role that Rice has exercised.
They've been more privately at the president's side, more privately, more low-key.
Yes, that's right. It was John Poindexter, mm-hmm. really, who was the first one to start giving public press conferences and doing lobbying on the Hill, which are two of the main things that Rice does. And Clinton's and Scowcroft under Bush did some of that, but Rice has done this to an unprecedented degree.
Has that given her more power, or is that evidence that she's in fact less powerful and therefore just public?
I think that Rice's exercise of that role to some degree is a substitute for the role of the security advisor as the sort of policy dean in the U.S. government.
In fact, in U.S. News and World Report, Kevin Whitelaw, you quote a senior U.S. official, unnamed, saying this is the most dysfunctional NSC that ever existed, but it's not Condi's fault. The person that made it so dysfunctional is Cheney.
Well, that's right. We've certainly been looking at a situation where you have the vice president playing sort of an unprecedentedly strong role in the management of policy and the role of the and the deliberations of the NSC.
I want to come back and look at that. We've got to take a short break. Kevin Whitelaw, John Prados mentioned Henry Kissinger. We'll be talking with Henry Kissinger on Thursday night here at On Point. Looking forward to hearing his point of view on all this. Should be interesting. We are talking tonight about the Condi factor, Condoleezza Rice, at the eye of the storm over 9/11. You can join the conversation tonight. Is the Rice commitment to testify before the 9/11 Commission a breakthrough or not? How do you interpret Condi Rice's role in the White House? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Condi factor in American security. My guests, Kevin Whitelaw, joining us from Washington, senior writer at U.S. News and World Report, and with us from Silver Spring, Maryland tonight, John Prados, analyst at the National Security Archive at George Washington University. You can join our conversation tonight. Did this Bush confidant and cold warrior get run over by Cheney and Rumsfeld? Did you see Condi Rice on 60 Minutes or everywhere else this weekend? Does she come across as credible, as in charge, as true? And could any national security advisor have negotiated the reported Powell-Rumsfeld clash over Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Though it was only today that she agreed to testify, Condoleezza Rice has put herself in the media spotlight frequently over the past week, sometimes facing a challenging barrage of questions. Here's an excerpt from her interview this past Sunday with 60 Minutes, Ed Bradley.
You're saying that the administration says fighting terrorism and al-Qaeda has been a top priority since the beginning.
I'm saying that the administration took seriously the threat. Let's talk about what we did,
which demonstrates that we took this as a priority. You've listed the things that you've done, but here is the perception. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at that time says you've pushed it to the back burner. The former Secretary of the Treasury says it was not a priority. Mr. Clark says it was not a priority. And at least according to Bob Woodward, who talked with the president, he is saying that for the president, it wasn't urgent. He didn't have a sense of urgency about al-Qaeda. That's the perception here.
Ed, I don't know what a sense of urgency, any greater than the one that we had, would have caused us to do differently. I think you have to look back to the 80s and most certainly the 90s, when what was happening was that the terrorist attacks were getting bolder, they were getting more imaginative, they were getting more daring. And that's because the terrorists were getting a sense of inevitability of their victory. We were not aggressively going after them. They believed that they were going to win. They saw us cut and run in Somalia. They go all the way back to the fact that the Marines left Beirut after the bombing of the barracks. And what they've been surprised by is the fact that this has this time been a launching of an all-out war on them. And yes, they're going to continue to try to attack. They're going to succeed sometimes, but they are going to be defeated. And as the president said, you cannot fight this war on the defensive.
Condoleezza Rice, steely under a pretty withering line of questioning from 60 Minutes. Ed Bradley there, broadcast Sunday night on 60 Minutes. Kevin Whitelaw, she is tough when the questions are tough. She is incredibly good at staying on message, up on the rails. Presumably she'll take that right into the hearing room with the 9/11 Commission.
Yeah, well, again, I think that's why the Republicans on the commission are so interested in having her testify. I think that they feel she's going to present quite a strong case for the president on his behalf and in front of the nation that way. And she derives a lot of her confidence and her strength from her close relationship with the president. When it comes to managing, you know, foreign policy and in the National Security Council, she has had a different role, and it's been less of that sort of brokering of policy and managing of foreign policy that we saw under the Clinton years with the National Security Council and the National Security Advisor, and it's
Sandy
been much
Berger.
More of she's been caught in the middle and is, according to people that we've been talking to, really, you know, found herself just sort of battling to try to deal with these differing views and the sort of Cheney-Rumsfeld alliance.
Well, talk to us about that.
I want to make a point here.
Yes, John Protos.
Is that one of Rice's main tasks, actually, is precisely in this area of public communications. I don't know if you've noticed this, but if you look at the progress of administration policy on Iraq in particular, you will find repeated instances in which Cheney, Bush, Rice, and Wolfowitz, or other two or three or four officials in combination, in very close coordination, deliver essentially the same message in a very tight and shortly focused period.
Oh, yeah, we've seen it again and again.
These kinds of combined sort of public relations offensives. And that's been one of Rice's main roles, and I think it's a replacement for the traditional role of policy vicar, which is the one that Cheney is subsuming in this administration.
And that seems a real comedown that you point to, John Protos. Kevin Whitelaw, you've written in detail about that in U.S. News and World Report. Describe this dynamic around Condoleezza Rice, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Powell, Rumsfeld, and you know the powerful currents running there and where she's fallen in them.
Well, you know, one thing that's actually quite interesting about her is it's often been very difficult to figure out exactly where she does fall on issues. And I think people in Washington who are not in those, in the room necessarily, have a lot of trouble figuring out where she falls on some of these issues.
But you've written that Cheney basically has moved into the National Security Council, already formally a member just by his office, but essentially running it, as you describe it, and in a close understanding with Rumsfeld, so close and so long-standing that they hardly have to talk, and Condi Rice then kind of running along beside is the way
I read it. What it comes down to is that, you know, Cheney's copied on absolutely everything that the NSC staff produces. He's involved in all the discussions. He has his own staff that's nearly as large as the staff of the NSC itself. He's got a huge staff of people that do a lot of these issues as well, and so there's sort of a whole apparatus there that is unusual in the White House. Meanwhile, with Rumsfeld and Cheney so in agreement on so many things, and Secretary Powell often being sort of coming from a very different perspective, it has left her in the middle, sometimes closer to Powell, sometimes closer to the Cheney and Rumsfeld, but very often one of the accusations is not actually expressing her own view much at all.
Right, not the maestro herself. Kevin Whitelaw, John Prado, stand by. I want to welcome to our conversation from New York, Laura Flanders. She's author of Bush Women. She's host of public radio program Your Call. Good evening and welcome, Laura Flanders.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
It's wonderful to have you. We've got a reading here in U.S. News of Condoleezza Rice, that polished, glittering earrings, elegant suits, graceful manner, steely demeanor, for all that, described as a kind of a Dick Cheney sock puppet. Is that accurate?
Well, I don't think that's a polite way to talk about anyone. And I also take a bit of offense at the sort of framing of this as the Condi factor. We never talked about the Hank factor when it came to Henry Kissinger.
Well, I don't know about that. There was an awful lot of talk about
aside,
Henry Kissinger. Very great volume of talk about Henry Kissinger. It's a big, important position. You've got to be ready to stand up and take
that.
The
I just
heat,
mean
don't
the
you?
Sort of the friendliness of using her nickname for the National Security Advisor. That aside, this is a sort of high-profile, low-stakes situation, it seems to me, with regard to Condoleezza Rice and the commission investigating 9/11. I agree with John, I mean, in fact, with both of your guests, that this is a character who has a very important role when it comes to spinning the public, but may not really have a role anywhere close to Dick Cheney's when it comes to actually making policy. And thinking about the history, it's very fascinating, because when Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice first served together was in the first Bush White House.
Right.
And at the time, the issue was the collapse of the Soviet Union. Well, that was one of the issues.
That's in her background, Sovietology.
And her expertise was in Sovietology, and they took very different positions back then.
Really?
Cheney was for getting in on the ground as the Soviet Union fell apart.
Mm-hmm.
He was for early relations with Boris Yeltsin and individual treaties with the breakaway republics. Condoleezza Rice, along with Brent Scowcroft and along with George W. Bush Sr., Herbert Walker Bush, took the position that better the enemy you know, the devil you know,
mm-hmm.
stick with Gorbachev, stick with the Soviet Union. In retrospect, the hawks, if you will, the Rumsfelds, the Cheneys, Wolfowitz and Pearl, and Libby, who was there at the time.
But not the Rice.
Not the Rice. They see Rice and Powell, who took the Gorbachev side of that debate, as having been wrong, really, and not having had a big enough vision. So it's always interested me that she was brought back into this administration kind of wounded, I think, and certainly vulnerable to the overpowering influence of the hawk himself, Dick Cheney.
So there's kind of a family history here. Let me ask you about the thing. I see what you're pointing to, the Condi factor. You're saying it's kind of sexist to be on such familiar media terms with Condoleezza Rice. On the other hand, I think part of the reason that that's emerged is that George Bush has this relationship, and it's hard to understand exactly what it is. Father, daughter, brother, sister, close confidants. But his calling her of Condi is
absolutely
so public that I think it's put it in the public domain. But what about that relationship? Is it a relationship that buttresses her power or in some funny way drains it? How do you read?
Well, it's interesting. And I think, you know, a national security advisor is somewhat drained when she's being of power, when she's being described as Condi by everyone, all and sundry. And I'm not blaming you. Absolutely. It's out there. That's how this woman is described. It's not Dr. Kissinger.
But
it's
what's the effect of that?
Rice. Well, I think, to go back to what John was saying.
One moment, John Prados. Just one moment, please. I want to get Laura Flanders on the record here.
Just to go back to what John was saying. I mean, I think there's been a lot of attention to this personal relationship. And what has been Condoleezza Rice's real strength has been in presenting a public image and developing, in a way, a personal relationship with the public. And she talks a lot, and a lot has been written about her personal history growing up in segregated Alabama. So she does play a kind of interpersonal role, relating the public to the president and vice versa. Very a critical media role. But I think John's right that she's playing a less powerful policymaking role as a result.
John Prados, I hear you there.
Yes, I want to interject something, and that is you have to understand how Condi Rice came about. And by the way, while we're talking about familiarity with security advisors, in fact, all during the Carter administration, we were talking about Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Yes, fair enough. He was on the other night.
Kissinger. It wasn't Dr. Kissinger, except when he was up in front of a news conference.
Yep.
It wasn't
Hank. But back to Condi Rice now.
Yeah. Okay.
We've got a guy, George Bush, doesn't know anything about foreign policy. He's coming up for president. And it was Condi Rice who stepped in to sort of hold his hand and lead him through. And that was the basis of her power and of her relationship with the current president.
That is not that he would be, not that she would be the wizard of foreign policy, but rather a kind of a tutor, a filter.
She was brought into that position.
She started as a tutor, but her problem arose with the advent of Richard Cheney and the Cheney policy machine. And then the problem became how to preserve a power position in Washington, D.C. And the way to do that was to stay close to the president. So essentially what you have is a duumvirate, really, of Rice with Bush responding to initiatives that are thrown at them, primarily by Cheney, but also by other power centers in the administration.
Although it is interesting to remember how Condoleezza Rice was introduced to George W. Bush, and that was through a very powerful player, namely George P. Schultz. It was Schultz of the Bechtel Corporation and no end of Republican administrations who made that connection, who brought Condoleezza Rice from the Hoover Institution, where she was, to meet with George W. in Austin. There were a lot of Hoover Institute fellows. I believe that she was already close to Scowcroft and Weinberger.
She was close to Scowcroft from the beginning. Scowcroft discovered
exactly
in California, and then this meteoric rise from the pastor's daughter to the provost, youngest ever provost at Stanford, and so on. But the question it leaves me with, and Kevin, let me put this to you, is what it means to have a national security advisor who may be something more like a confidant, advisor, tutor to the president than a real policymaker. What does that do to the shape of policy that comes out of the White House?
Well, you know, I think there, you know, there's 2 points here. One is that there's still a bit of an outstanding question about whether she, you know, whether the fact that she hasn't been able to sort of stand up and stand up to the Cheney Rumsfeld juggernaut has anything to do with her unwillingness to try to do that or her inability, whether anybody would be capable of doing it. She might simply be in an impossible position. And so there's an interesting question about whether this is actually a reflection of who she is or whether it's simply, the decks are completely stacked against her in this White House, especially when the president himself is not has never been an expert in a lot of these issues.
We have been keeping our callers waiting, and I want to turn to them. Michael's calling from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question, I've been following this rather closely from Iowa.
Good for you.
Thank you. But the Richard Clark issue and the Paul O'Neill book and all the testimony and now Condoleezza Rice coming on board to testify,
yep.
It seems that you're credible enough to be Secretary of the Treasury. You're credible enough to be in this position that Richard Clark was for 30 years and over various White Houses. And now all of a sudden when you have just something to say that it seems salient, you're no longer credible. What does somebody in the middle of this country need to listen for and look for to really know when one of these witnesses is a credible witness?
Well, it's a good question, Michael. Thanks for calling. John Prudis, I get, first of all, to something that Michael's raising indirectly here, how much a part of the what's been described as kind of attack machine against critics is Condi Rice? Is she that focused on the public face that she's the generator of that pushback when the criticism comes in?
I'm not sure that Rice is the generator. There is a White House committee, more than one committee probably, that does, in fact, center on what the public message should be at any given time. But Rice is certainly one of the primary participants, and you can see in just the segue of interviews that she gave over the week to 10 days since the Clark testimony occurred, just how centered she is exactly on knocking him down.
Oh, yeah,
and she,
like a laser.
In fact, went far enough to contradict some of her own statements in those very same interviews. That's how hard she was pushing the issue. But to answer the caller's original point,
yes.
I think what you need to listen for is the ability and knowledge of the person. The question of credibility is solved by, in fact, their knowledge and involvement with the issue. And if they are speaking things that you know to be true from other sources, that's where you establish that they're credible, and that's where you listen to the rest of what they have to say.
It's a pretty tough call. Kevin Whitelaw, we just got you for another minute here. One of the things you say in your piece is that the kind of dysfunction that you quote officials describing around the National Security Council may actually be working to President Bush's advantage. It leaves different parties angry with Rumsfeld or with Colin Powell, but him a little bit exempt from that, and that maybe Condoleezza Rice's particular role has allowed that dynamic to develop. Let the president stay apart from the fiercest part of the flak flying here.
Well, it certainly is what one of our sources called the cynical view of what's going on here. And if you notice the debate this week, it really has been focused quite a lot on the different advisors, and a little bit less on the president. Ultimately, the president is the one who sets the tone for how he wants his administration run. And so I think that is worth keeping in mind in all of these discussions about all the different advisors are that there's still somebody who's actually in charge of this apparatus and is supposed to be managing all of this. And so whether you look at policies in places like the war with Iraq and other things where there really were some incredibly serious, difficult policy disputes that were not effectively resolved for quite a long time and in many cases still haven't fully been resolved at the White House, you do have to sort of, the blame goes all the way up to the president in terms of how these various things have been managed. In many cases, it's because he's delegated it to working levels who are not always being effectively coordinated, perhaps by an apparatus that's not capable of mastering the people in charge of the different heads of it. It's a complicated machine over there, but there is still somebody at the top of it.
Well, there's somebody at the top, and Condoleezza Rice right next to that somebody at the top. We're looking tonight at the Condoleezza Rice factor, the Condi factor. Condoleezza Rice at the eye of the storm over 9/11. Kevin Whitelaw at U.S. News and World Report, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Laura Flanders, John Prado, stand by. Listeners, you can join our conversation. What is Condoleezza Rice to George Bush? A filter, a tutor, a booster, a soulmate? Do you want Condoleezza Rice, weak or strong? What difference does that make? And do you expect new revelations from her testimony or the Steel Magnolia routine? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Condi factor and American security. Condoleezza Rice at the eye of the storm over 9/11. I'm joined tonight from New York by Laura Flanders, author of Bush Women and host of the public radio program Your Call, from Silver Spring, Maryland by John Prados, analyst at the National Security Archive at George Washington University, and now from Palo Alto, California by Kyron Skinner. She's a longtime friend of Condoleezza Rice. She's a fellow at the Hoover Institution, a professor of international affairs at Carnegie Mellon University, a member of Donald Rumsfeld's Defense Policy Board. We're delighted to have her. Good evening and welcome, Kyron Skinner.
Hi, thanks.
Thanks a lot for being with us. Condi Rice is somebody that you know very, very well, Kyron Skinner. How do you interpret how she's taking all this? She's reported to be weary and unsettled, but stoic. Is that an accurate description?
That's not my sense of how she's handling this current situation. Given her record, you have to realize she's been in controversies before, and very public ones, mm-hmm. because she started so early her career. Very high profile by her mid-20s as a Sovietologist at Stanford. But really, if you watched her as provost of Stanford, she was the provost well before she was 40 years old. You can't be in a more controversial position at
right.
a major university dealing with all kinds of issues. And at Stanford, the provostship is particularly difficult because the person who holds that job is both the chief budget officer
yes.
and the chief academic officer.
Yep.
Two very different sets of problems that come together in all kinds of ways, and she handled that quite well. So I don't think this is new. It's at a different level because it is international, and it connects in so many ways to so many issues and puts her in the spotlight in a way that she's never been before. But if you look at her own record, I don't think that she's handling this in any way different than the past.
On the other hand, these are huge issues, and you've got affairs of state just grinding and grinding here. You've been quoted saying that Condi Rice's poise almost seems to be a gift from God that she has developed through deep faith. Her father was a minister. She is herself a woman of deep religious faith, something she shares with George Bush. Can you feel her drawing on that in these times?
I do, but I don't think that this is as much of a crisis, actually, as the media and some are making it out to be.
You think they're just playing checkers out there at Camp David with their feet up on the table? And
I don't think that that's going on, but I don't think that there's a crisis right now in the way. There's always something going on in Washington, and I think when you step back from the noise, there is not as much going on around Condi as many would think. I think it's often a mistake to make big judgments
mm-hmm.
about how the policy process is really working when you're on the outside as an analyst and you're just talking to whomever you can to write up your essays and so forth. I think one of the big lessons I've learned from my research on Reagan and the end of the Cold War is that it really takes time to understand how an administration works, and often you can't do it in real time. So some of the charges that are being leveled that, Cheney's really running the show, she's running in a parallel universe, all of this, I'm not sure we really are qualified to make those broad statements at this particular time.
John Prados, what do you make of that? A sound and fury signifying nothing and all of this?
I have to disagree. The entire presentation of this administration vis-a-vis information now, and really we're talking about the role of Alberto Gonzalez as White House counsel,
yes.
has been to shut down the flow of information out of the White House to make it quite secure from the president's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And that was precisely the approach that the White House took to this situation. They refused to permit Rice to appear before the committee in open session. When they did let her appear, it was in closed session and with no records made of the testimony.
Right.
And now they've stepped back from all three of the positions that they took. She's going to be in open session, she will be under oath, and there will be an open record. And the only reason I submit that they would have stepped back like that on three major issues for them had to be that they perceived, not me, but they perceived this as a situation where they were in significant trouble.
Well, that is a line they've been very firm on in the past. I want to try and get a few more callers in. Carlene is calling from Brooklyn, Wisconsin. Hi, Carlene. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. I just have a comment. As a female and a Democrat, I'm looking at this from the position of believing Richard Clark and thinking to myself that the administration plans to let Condi Rice take the fall. And part of their thinking, in my view, in having her testify is exactly that.
So put her out there and make her the target. That's an interesting observation. Carlene, thanks for your call. Laura Flanders, what do you make of that? The fall gal here in Condi Rice?
I don't think so. I mean, I have to say I'm with Kyron on this. I actually interviewed Kyron for my book. She's a very good source with a lot of insight into Condoleezza Rice.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Condoleezza is particularly frazzled by what's going on right now, and I don't think there's a lot going to come out in front of the commission under oath that hasn't come out already in the press and in the private investigation. I think what we're seeing here...
Yeah.
Well, two things. One, we're seeing a lot of publicity about this person and much less attention on the president, on Dick Cheney. I think that's a pity, and I don't think it's going to be such big bang for the buck, really, when she does testify. Not to mention, of course, she's going to be testifying in front of somebody with whom she authored a book, Philip Sellico, so I don't think mm-hmm. the questioning is going to be all that tough. But I agree with Karen that Condoleezza has been in a very tough spot before. I mean, she came into the first Bush administration, and very soon afterwards, she had to be defending that administration's record on what else but the continued funding of Saddam Hussein's Iraq for 2 years after the gassing of the Iranians and the Kurds, and right up until August 2nd, 1990, the day before the Iraqi invasion
yep.
of Kuwait, where, you know, you had Iraq's access to U.S. agricultural products, including biological agents like anthrax and botulinum toxins, going through with the approval of the man who went on to become Director of Central Intelligence, Robert Gates. I mean, Condoleezza went out of her way to defend Gates. And it's a real irony now that that was a very tendentious moment, defending what looks like, you know, skewed intelligence to support Congress continuing to support Saddam. Now she's under the gun, having to address an administration that looks like, well, it used flawed intelligence to goad Congress into trying to take him down.
Okay, so we know she's got the brass to defend difficult policies in public, but this time, and I wonder how you can soft sell it, this time George Bush seems to be planting his run for re-election pretty squarely on his record as a wartime president, how he handled national security. If that is what has come into question in the last 2 weeks, doesn't that put Condoleezza Rice as national security advisor in an awkward spot?
Well, I think the administration's in an awkward spot, but I don't think Condoleezza's in the worst seat, and I think she'll handle it well. And it looks bad to have so many critics of the administration coming down so hard on Condoleezza Rice. It would look better, in a sense, for them to be coming down this hard on Dick Cheney or George W. Bush. And I think those images are very important. She doesn't look like an oil man like Dick
right.
Cheney does,
mm-hmm.
even though she did head up, was on the board of directors of Chevron
and
for over a decade.
Named after her.
Had a tanker named after her, and so on and so forth. I mean, she's arguably been as involved in the oil trade and oil interests as Dick Cheney has, but she has a very different public image, in part because of the stereotypes that still, persist
yeah.
in
yeah.
our culture.
Mm-hmm. Kyron Skinner, what about our caller's suggestion that Condoleezza Rice might be being set up as the fall gal here? Does that jive with your understanding of the dynamics within the White House at all?
No, and again, I go back to my point, which I don't think John Prados really addressed, and it doesn't have to be addressed here. I don't think that there is a this fight between Condi and Cheney, and that there's something here that's a major and exceptional story. I think that there's a lot of noise, and I think what's going on is that it's easy to focus on bureaucratic infighting insofar as one can perceive it. That's always interesting. It always takes place.
But this isn't just bureaucratic infighting. This is about the president's reelection, as we've seen it presented.
But let me finish my sentence, and I think that always happens, and it happened a lot during the Reagan years. When you think about Shultz and Weinberger, sometimes it was perhaps worse even than was being portrayed. But underneath all of this, I think what's going on is that the international system, for the first time since the ending of the Cold War, it's become clearer to us what international system we're really in. And with the Cold War ending, we lacked for most of the 90s, all of the 90s, in fact, a strategic doctrine to deal with the world. We were trying to figure out if we were in a multipolar world, a unipolar world. And I think since September 11th, we have now started to have a strategic doctrine, which we didn't have, replacing containment. I think the Global Posture Review is an example of that. President Bush announced that on November 25th.
So you're saying it's a unipolar world, and Condi Rice has recognized and embraced that.
And I think that it's hard to deal with an international system like the one that we've had, that we are presently in now. And so I think the attention is on something that's easier to focus on.
Well,
And I think it's harder to deal with the fact that the most difficult scenario in international relations is when you're an open society and your adversary is not only closed, but it's transnational. That's the hardest scenario. And instead of focusing on how do we build a doctrine that deals with and thwarts potential threats, we focus on things like the bureaucratic politics of this administration. I understand that, but I don't think it's as big as the problem that is, in fact, being addressed by this administration.
Karen says a really interesting thing. I would only differ in that I don't think that the beginning of the thinking about a new strategic doctrine only started after September 11th. We know that many of the players in this administration were part of the project for a new American century that halfway through the 90s was urging Bill Clinton to prioritize exactly what has happened, the redrawing of the Middle Eastern map and the taking out of Saddam Hussein. Unfortunately, it confirms what Richard Clark and Paul O'Neill say, which was that Iraq was at the center of these people's minds when they came in, not Al-Qaeda, not the Taliban, not domestic sleeper cells of terrorists.
Let me try and get one more call here. Chris is calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Just great, Chris.
Hey, I had two questions, and I just want to kind of refocus the discussion back to this testimony that's going to happen. And my first question is, how is this testimony going to be anything but saving face for Condoleezza, especially since she's been, resisted a public hearing at her oath for so long, and she's been on all these different media outlets? And my second question is can this committee be nonpartisan and get her to answer questions directly without being evasive, like we've seen on so many of these other programs, where the evasiveness that she's pretty much coined for and being steely for can this committee actually get her to speak with definitive clarity on these issues?
And very candidly, Chris, we've got it. Our time is short. Let us pick that up. John Prado, what do you think of the main question there? Is this committee going to really put the pressure on Condi Rice and hear something new, or is she cool, calm, and collected, and like Kyron Skinner says, simply elucidating a new view of the world that everybody needs to hear?
I think they're going to have a significant problem in getting something big out of Condoleezza Rice. They have some things that they can push on, in particular the August 6, 2001 presidential daily brief and the whole situation of the actions that were taken by the administration between that spring and that fall. And Rice will be under oath, which is the big difference, so that she can't evade so easily, and questioners can come back to her once again and after a time.
And John, we've just got another minute, but let me ask you to go to the heart of what Kyron Skinner was saying. She's saying, look, this is not someone being run over by vice presidents and secretaries of defense. She's powerful. She's helped articulate a new view of the world. This is what national security advisors should do. This is all just a flap about bureaucratic infighting.
This is not about bureaucratic infighting. This is about, in fact, the central policy of the United States in the current international situation, with all due regard to the questions of multilateral versus unipolar world organizations. In fact, the question is the policy that was pursued by the United States government and the lack or presence of a doctrinal approach and an articulated foreign policy in the actions that it was taking in the world.
Whether that left the United States open on 9/11. We've just got a few seconds left. Kyron Skinner, do you think that Condi Rice may still be Secretary of State a year from now, let's say?
I haven't thought that far because I'm trying to really think about the issues of strategy and doctrine. And I think what's really being missed here again is that the administration has really been working, especially, I think, since articulating the global posture.
We have heard that loud and clear from you. We're out of time, I'm afraid, now, though. Kyron Skinner, I'm sorry, that's just where we are. I think we did hear that pretty clearly, and it sounds, we can hear your longtime association with Condi Rice right there. You guys are cut from the same cloth, and it's a tough one. Kyron Skinner, thanks very much for joining us tonight, Professor of International Affairs at Carnegie Mellon. Laura Flanders, author of Bush Women, thanks very much for being with us from New York.
You're welcome.
And John Prados, analyst at the National Security Archive at George Washington University, author of Keeper of the Keys, A History of the National Security Council from Truman to Bush. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.